Support for the Commodity Week podcast comes from Strategic Farm Marketing in Champaign with crop insurance, grain marketing, and commodity brokerage services. Learn more at sfarmmarketing.com. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
This is the Friday, March 25th edition of Commodity Week.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
A shipment of corn has been sold to, well, someone, but who? And next week, USDA will estimate how many acres of each crop farmers will plant this season. We'll guess at both today on Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Later in this half hour, we'll hear from ag economist Daryl Good about the methodology USDA NASS uses for its reports. Our panelists today include Matt Bennett of TGM, that's Total Grain Marketing out of Windsor, Illinois, Ellen Dearden of Ag Review from Morton, Illinois, and Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities from Newmarket, Indiana. Here's the way futures settled on the week. Remember, we give you the high, the low, the open outcry, and the electronic weekly trade Friday to Friday. May corn futures is $7.17 and a quarter top this week, bottom at $6.73. Settlement price at 689.5, up 6 cents from the previous Friday. December corn futures, 624 the high. Low at 596, settlement price at 609.5, up 11 cents. May beans at 1376 and 3 quarter top, bottom at 1338, settled 1358 and a quarter, down 4 and a quarter. And November futures, 1359 the high, the low at 1323.5. Settlement price for November beans at $13.50 and a quarter cents, up 16 and one quarter. July wheat is 787 at a quarter top, bottom at 740 and three quarters, settled 768 and three quarters, up 10 and a quarter. And the live cattle futures had a high this week at 118.65, a low at 112.10, settled 118.60, up $6.95. The feeder cattle March contract to 132.10 top, bottom at 122.70, settled 131.90, up 390. And lean hogs in the April, 93.15 the top, the bottom at $88, settled 92.47.5, up $4.15. Again, our panelists in studio today include Matt Bennett, Ellen Dearden, and Wayne Nelson. Mr. Nelson, we'll start with you. USDA's reports are due out next Thursday morning. Will there be any surprises based on the acreage that is due from the United States Department of Agriculture?
Well, I'm sure there's going to be a surprise, Todd, because this is the most skittish I've ever seen the trade be over this March 31st report. And all the years I've been in the grain business, I've never seen so much indecision as what we're looking at here. Of course, everybody is feeling the government's going to come with around a 90, somewhere close to 92 million acres of corn and probably a 77 million acres in the beans. You know, as we look at a lot of things, that could change a little bit because of the strength in the cotton market and depending on how the government looks at whether there'll be some wheat abandonment.
Ellen Dearden, your review of next Thursday morning's reports?
On the acreage side, I would agree with Wayne. The market's really pretty nervous about this. At local meetings that I've had, it sure appears that there's a push to increase corn acres, maybe 5% or something along that line in Illinois and Indiana. But I'm sticking with 91.7 million corn acres and about just shy of 77 million bean acres. I think we'll see a large abandonment on both the hard red and the soft red winter wheat crop by the time it's all said and done. But a good portion of that's going to go to cotton in Oklahoma and Texas.
And Matt Bennett of TGM.
Yeah, I'd kind of echo what the first two said. I think, you know, when you look at the way this market has been the last couple of weeks, and then this week, I think is mostly attributable to looking forward to the report. It's very uneasy. People are wondering, are we going to be much under 92 or much over 92? There's all kinds of guesses out there, but you know, my opinion is we should be around the 91.5 to 92. I know there's been a lot of talk about the soybean and corn price ratio, but my opinion on it is most guys have a pretty good idea where they're going to be. Last fall is completely different from the previous fall in that we, you know, most of the work got done. And I think most guys made their decisions last fall for the most part. There will be some swing anchors like always, but this year, you know, we got to keep in mind if there's swing anchors, the weather's going to play a role. And so far, the weather's not really cooperating.
On Friday of this past week, the FarmDoc team member Gary Schnitke released just a little bit on what the price ratios for each county in the 12 Midwestern states might be and whether corn or soybeans would be the winner or more profitable in that case. All but just a few of them showed corn acres to be more profitable. And the thing that was most important as I had a discussion with him was that the corn acres on highly productive land in central Illinois would out-yield in terms of dollars, soybean acres, by $188 per acre, which is a record and a record setter by a long shot. The largest gap was $118. That came just a few years ago, and usually it's something like $30 or $40. Do you think, Matt, that that'll be enough to push farmers in our part of the world to put more corn acres in?
Well, we've talked about this a couple of times before, Todd. I think guys that went ahead and ripped their ground last fall that couldn't get the anhydrous on, which was a fairly common theme because of the dryness of the fall, you know, they have a chance to switch acreage. And, you know, anhydrous isn't extraordinarily high. You know, we're looking at 750 to 850, I think, depending on where you're at. And, you know, I think that there's a very real chance there'll be some acreage switch. But again, I think last year, the bean yields, especially in the heart of the Midwest, were pretty solid. And I think a lot of guys understand the amount of money to put into the bean crop isn't near what it is to put into the corn crop. So I see what you're saying, and I agree with what Mr. Schnitke is saying. But I don't think there will be a large swing. I think much of that has already been factored in, and it'll be really interesting to see what the USDA comes out with. I don't know that there'll be as much switch from, you know, from this early report to the June 30th report this year. I'm not sure that we'll have that much of a switch. A lot of it will depend on spring weather, but I don't know that there'll be a huge change.
Ellen, you have an estimate for acreage for corn that's under the 92 million USDA has in the pipeline at this point. Of course, that'll be updated on Thursday when the reports come out. On that estimate, that's what you're figuring farmers will do. Do you think that's what they should do?
Well, certainly in high-yielding areas, we'll see things skewed towards corn, so we may end up with more bushels even if the acres aren't at 92. You know, my suggestion is as soon as the weather's fit, you go out and start planting corn if you're in the high-yielding areas in Illinois and Indiana and in your listening area. I would agree that it's sure cheaper to put in a bean crop, but I don't see that farmers are extremely pressed for money at this stage of the game.
Do they need to be doing anything, Ellen, to follow up once they start putting those acres in the ground? They probably already have crop insurance. Should they cover themselves in other ways?
I think it is beneficial to be looking at the $6 cash price for out of the field for guys who have decent basis. I'm not saying that you price, you know, 70% or 80% or whatever you've got your crop insurance to, but it's certainly a place to get going.
Wayne, as you went through that crop insurance writing period, did you have producers that you hadn't seen before come in? And what do you think producers should be doing now as well?
Well, I think number one, we saw at the beef house, Todd, that probably 95% of the farmers are using crop insurance now. As you well know, you sign up for a plan for the county, so no matter whether you switch to corn or beans here, as long as you signed up for both policies, you would have them, so that's okay. I think that we saw a lot of people that went to 85% coverage that had 80% last year because of the way that the price that they were at and the dollars they could insure, and it would help them if they did want to make some sales that way. I think you asked Ellen a question there.
if they were going to plant more corn when they get out there, if we're still up in this range, remember even the grip policy only goes up to 90%, and then the revenue policy only goes up to 85% of your APH. So you probably want to be covering that 10 to 15% that's extra up near those that $6 level, near the $13.50 level, or the insurance level as we look at. The other thing that, going back a question, was, Todd, the talk of whether we just go to all corn in the state of Illinois. I think there was some very disappointing corn-on-corn yields where they had put multiple years of corn out there last year. They're going to keep a few people wanting to plant a few acres of beans in certain instances.
Now, you all know that I had forwarded out the piece from Gary this morning, on Friday morning, that is, about the acreage and corn versus soybean and the profitability. I did get one response that came back with the suggestion that the only place they thought they might really see a switch was in really high-end cash rent acres. I wondered if anybody's thought about how many of those might be out there and if that's a significant amount. And I'll open that question up to anybody who thinks they can answer it. USDA, of course, does a survey. We probably could pull the numbers out of it if we tried pretty hard, I think.
Yeah, I think, Todd, that it's a very valid point. You know, if you're looking at a $400 to $500 cash acre, cash rent per acre scenario, which we've heard of several of them across the Midwest, it would be pretty tough, I think, to go ahead and pencil that out with beans as easy as it would be with corn. I think, you know, obviously, like I said before, you have a situation where there's a lot less as far as input costs, but, you know, the high-yielding areas are most of the time where your biggest cash rent will be. And, you know, if you've got an APH of 190 to 200 ground that's capable of 240 bushel corn, it can certainly still pencil out.
Ellen, I want to turn to exports with you just for a moment. It appears, according to USDA or according to USDA numbers and some back figuring that Daryl Good did earlier this week, that inspections need to average something like 42.2 million acres for the final 24 weeks of the season. But we've been averaging something more along the lines of 33.3 in those previous weeks. Can we manage that in the coming months?
Well, the only way we're going to manage that is if we can see the end user source corn in the country, and we did see the Gulf basis improve a little bit and the end of this week, but I think it's going to be really pretty tough to get back up over 40 million bushel.
And so is that because Japan is under duress in short term, or are there other reasons behind it?
I think the difficulty is being able to source corn for export, not the fact that there aren't buyers out there. And certainly Japan is probably going to be a little slow to take corn till it's got its ports, the four ports that have been destroyed, till we work through that. But my guess is we're just having difficulty from an exporter standpoint of sourcing corn in the country.
Oh, that's interesting, because as I think about then, normally you would think of a lower export inspections figure as a difficult thing for price, meaning it might go lower. But in this case, you're saying it just can't find the corn, and that is a positive for the marketplace. Did I get that right?
I think so. And certainly when you look at an average of where able to ship about 33 million bushel a week, and we need to ship 42 million bushel. The other thing that stands out to me is that means USDA is going to lower that export number on this next supply-demand report in April and increase the carryout. It'll be interesting to see what happens on the grain stocks report that comes out on Thursday as well.
Yeah, the grain stocks report, as you mentioned, is coming out Thursday along with the acreage report. Wayne Nelson, what do you make of the numbers and expectations there?
Well, I think that that's the bigger question mark, actually, than the acres, Todd. I think that we've heard the rumors that the commercials are trying to say that the farmers, when they give their surveys, because of the much heavier test weight by as much as 7 to 8 pounds compared to the year before, underestimated the amount of corn in their bin, and when they hauled it out, you know, there might have been an extra 5% in the bin. That also then the feed conversions along the same lines, and also supposedly for using the bushels for the ethanol production might have kicked up, or they might have got more gallons of ethanol because of the better quality corn, and that being a big user out there right now. So that's going to be the question mark. Now, if that was really China that did that 1.25 million metric tons today, and we were only penciling them in on the carryout or for the usage at a million metric tons, that might be the difference in how they make up for that extra sale. As we looked at it today, that might erase some of the extra stocks that might be on hand as of the report next Thursday.
Time for a final word from each of you. We'll go ahead and start with you, Wayne Nelson.
But Todd, we got a big report coming up next Thursday. I think we're going to continue to see some risk being taken off the table by some of the large funds and some of the small speculators. We look for a very choppy week with a slightly downward bias.
Ellen Dearden?
Well, I expect to see at least the outset of next week continue the late trend in corn, which was lower on Friday. I look for a lot of chop to continue even after this report. Don't let it all just hang out there. Protect some of it.
And Matt Bennett.
Yeah, I agree. It'll be choppy into the report, and I think it'll be really interesting to see what our weather patterns look like after the report, regardless of what the numbers are. I think things can still be swayed up or down.
You've been listening to the March 25th edition of Commodity Week. More in a moment when we talk with University of Illinois ag economist Darryl Good. Our panelists include Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana, Matt Bennett of TGM from Windsor, Illinois, and Ellen Dearden of Ag Review out of Morton, Illinois. Back in just 2 minutes.
I'm Steve Hilberg with the Midwestern Regional Climate Center located at the Illinois State Water Survey in Champaign. The warmer-than-normal weather that brought a taste of spring to Illinois came to a crashing end this week on the heels of a strong cold front. Temperatures early this week averaged more than 15 degrees above normal in southern Illinois to around 4 degrees above normal in northern Illinois. By Thursday, however, everything reversed and temperatures were running 10 to 12 degrees below normal. Precipitation was heaviest this week in northern Illinois, closer to where the frontal boundary lingered much of the week. The heaviest precipitation occurred last weekend when an inch and a half to more than 2 inches of rain fell in some northeastern counties. Following the mild weather, light snow dusted much of northern Illinois Wednesday night into Thursday morning as the cold air streamed southward into the state. It looks like we have entered into a somewhat extended period of colder weather, one that will likely take us through into early April, although we will see a few warmer days. Some precipitation should occur across the southern half of Illinois this weekend. That will be followed by a couple of days of dry weather, and then a strong low may develop in the central plains early in the week, and that could bring significant precipitation to Illinois beginning late Tuesday or on Wednesday. High pressure should then bring drier and cooler weather to finish out next week. For the Midwestern Regional Climate Center in Champaign, I'm Steve Hilberg.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of 5 new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason in studio with us today. Darryl Good, ag economist from the U of I and the College of Vases, to talk about one of their latest penned papers. It's on the methodology that USDA uses to develop some of the numbers for the acreage reports and other reports. Tell me, why did you do it?
Well, Todd, we kind of have listened to folks talk over time and had the feeling that USDA is grossly misunderstood, to some extent has a bad rap in terms of how they put together the numbers for their acreage and production forecasts. And it appeared to us a lot of people didn't understand how they do that, even though they've documented in detail their methodology. People don't tend to read that. And secondly, some people believe that USDA has a kind of a hidden agenda or a motive for the numbers that they actually publish. So our idea was to review their methodology and then try to present that in a brief layman's terms so that users of the data could have a better understanding of how the numbers are put together.
Which reports did you take up?
We looked at three specifically. One, the methodology for the Prospective Plannings Report that's now released at the end of March each year, the June Acreage Report that's done at the end of June, that's when it's released, and then the monthly yield forecast August through November of each year. So we looked up kind of the sample size, the methodology of all of those reports and tried to capture that in fairly brief terms.
And can you give us a broad perspective but short on how they go about doing it?
Well, I think the thing that a lot of folks don't understand is, particularly for the June acreage survey and the monthly yield forecast, that the USDA actually uses two sampling methods. One, where they actually survey producers directly and ask them their acreage intentions or actual plantings, in the case of the June report. And then for the monthly yield estimates, they survey farmers and ask them directly, what do you expect your average yield to be this year? But also for those final two reports, the June acreage and the yield estimates, USDA actually has what they call an area frame sample, where they determine before the season starts specific segments of agricultural land throughout the major producing states. And they actually go to those segments each month during the forecast cycle and take measurements of crops that are there and use that data to forecast yield and acreage as well. So it's the combination of those two surveys that go into the final estimates for the acreage and the yield estimates.
Is there a difference with the Prospective Plantings Report?
Prospective Plantings Report does not involve an area frame sample. That is what they call a list frame survey, where they just send questionnaires to farmers directly. There is no field observation on that because it is intentions. There's really nothing to look at that point when the data is collected for the March Prospective Plantings Report.
Do we know how many surveys they send out?
It varies by report. The June survey is part of their major ag survey. They send out over 80,000 survey forms on that. And for the area frame sample, where they're actually looking at segments of land, in 2010, that was about 1,900 segments for corn and soybeans throughout the major corn and soybean producing states.
Is there any underlying directive that you know about or that USDA is put under pressure by administration or other folks to move those statistical numbers around to meet needs?
You know, absolutely not. I think what you would see looking at their methodology is it's a very statistically sound methodology, very objective methodology. And, you know, even if there was some agenda to shade the numbers one way or another, at the end of the day, that bias or that motivation would be uncovered because at some point we'll know actual crop size. And so if you're trying to shade the number, you're eventually going to get caught doing that, if you will, because the chickens come home to roost at the end of the day. So it is a very objective survey. USDA is measuring those things that matter to yield. And they are capturing the historical relationships between the things that they can observe and measure and the actual corn and soybean yields. Because they're using both types of sampling, list frame that asking farmers and also observing in the field, they really get the benefit of what we call composite forecasting. That is, where you're using more than one methodology to get at the same number. Statistically, that adds a lot of power to the forecast that they develop. Now, I think there are continue to be some misunderstandings about USDA reports and some inherent shortcomings, particularly on the yield forecasting numbers. Obviously, early in the forecasting cycle, USDA can only observe and measure what's there. So in August and September, in a lot of years, there's not a lot to look at in terms of ears or pods, so they have to go by plant counts and that type of thing. And what we know is that the relationship between those kind of factors and actual yield is not constant, that if you have so many ears per acre in one year, that doesn't give you the same yield every year. So there is some relationship problems there, that you can only measure what's there, and then they're not a perfect forecast of what the actual yield is. And I think a lot of people don't understand that they are actually using two different sampling procedures, and that they are capturing the benefit of those two methodologies. So that falls into the misunderstanding category rather than a shortcoming of the methodology. You would also have to say that that there is, I think, not understood that USDA is basing these estimates and forecasts on a sample. They're not looking at every field in the country. They're not asking every farmer. They're asking a sample. And that does introduce what is called sampling error, that if you ask a different set of farmers the same question, or if you observed a different set of fields, you might reach a different conclusion than what you reached looking at the sample that was actually used. And also, in the early part of the yield forecasting cycle, in August and September, the assumption is always made, we measure what's there and then assume that weather is normal for the rest of the season until the crop matures. And as we know, that's not always a correct assumption. Sometimes weather is not normal from early August to the end of the maturity period, so that that kind of problem can get introduced into the early yield forecast when weather patterns are different than normal or average. So, I mean, they're statistically sound procedures, but inherently there are some shortcomings, because you can only measure what's there and you can only use historical relationships between those measurements and actual yields to forecast this year's yield. And those relationships are not perfect.
Those who would like to view this particular marketing and outlook brief can find it on the FarmDoc sites. There are two of them now, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu and farmdoc.illinois.edu. Thank you so much, Daryl.
Thank you, Todd.
Daryl Good, Ag Economist from the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for Commodity Week comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333. And by ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers, because everything they do starts with you.